Sonnenfeld, you're listening to Speaking of Animals, and I'm delighted to have Nancy Perry of the Humane Society of the United States with me today. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, Lori. How are you?
Fine. How are you doing?
Good. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you. Are you from Oregon?
Yeah. Well, I went to law school at Lewis and Clark and
yes.
spent several years there, and I worked on the campaign, and I've been in KBOO and
yes, I'm
talked
sure,
to you before.
I'm sure.
It's so fun to be back.
Yes. Welcome back. And so now you're in Washington, D.C.
Yes. I moved here from Portland, one of the bigger mistakes of my life, and I've never been able to extract myself. Someday I'm coming back, though.
So there's a lot of confusion, I think, among people. What is the Humane Society of the United States, and how is it different from, like, the Humane Society?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, the Humane Society of the United States is its own separate, distinct nonprofit organization. It is the largest animal protection organization in the country, and we have close connections to and ties with and relationships with the local humane societies and SPCAs all over the country. There are some 3,000 to 4,000 of them around the country, but we are not technically affiliated. The Oregon Humane Society is a wonderful organization that we work with on many partnerships, but they are their own organization. So that's a great question to ask. But our job really is to work on education at the national level and to provide materials to and support for smaller organizations around the country, and we work very hard on federal and state legislation around the country as well.
Mm-hmm. And I remember that you were involved, I think, with the original bear and cougar legislation here in Oregon.
I was, and yeah. That happened because we had an animal law group at the law school, and we became involved in the regulatory process when we really wanted to see some protections put in place for bears and cougars, because Oregon was lagging way behind the rest of the country in that regard. And when the ODF&W refused to do that, we said, well, let's see what the people of Oregon want. And we got together and got the signatures and put our measure on the ballot and had people decide for themselves that they really wanted that protection in place. So it's been a battle since then to try to retain it, because there have been a lot of sneaky sort of backdoor efforts by the legislature, none of which have prevailed. There was an attempt to overturn it 2 years later, and that actually was defeated by twice as large a margin as the original measure was voted in.
Right.
So we know that the support for these animals only grows out with real Oregonians, but I'm afraid that those who want to hunt them are very powerful and very organized, and we have to keep fighting.
So the Humane Society of the United States is part of a group of conservation and humane organizations who filed suit recently in U.S. District Court for the District of Oregon to stop federal and state agencies from killing 4,000 cougars over a 5-year period?
That's correct. We are working with Big Wildlife and Oregon Humane Society and Klamath Siskiyou Wildlands Center and BARC and Cascadia Wildlands Project and the Mountain Lion Foundation and the Umpqua Watersheds.
And that's,
so we've all banded together.
And this is a target of killing approximately 4,000 cougars out of an estimated population of 5,100?
Yeah, how's that math sound to you?
It sounds outrageous.
It's unbelievable. I mean, they just want to wipe out wholesale these animals. Rather than, you know, the claim is, well, we need to do this because, you know, we don't want damage to occur by these cougars. We don't want any danger for people. And yet, you know, what's been going on is if there's a problem individual within that population, then they go out and they capture that animal and take that animal out of the population.
That's part of the original legislation, right?
Yeah, we allowed for that because we obviously don't believe that people should be put in jeopardy, but we also don't fear that that's a serious problem. It turns out that one of the studies conducted by a cougar biologist, a very renowned cougar biologist, Dr. Paul Beyer, shows that up to 95% of all cougar sightings and complaints are actually misidentification situations, where people see what they think might be a cougar, but it's actually a house cat or another wildlife species. You know, because in that moment it's very fast and people get excited and, you know, afraid, and when your heart's pounding you might not be able to tell. But of course these things do happen, and there is a mechanism in the current law that allows for the wholesale destruction of any individual cougar that is causing a problem.
Uh-huh.
And that seems to be the best way to go, and really we should just allow that to continue to work as it is.
So briefly, what happened that brought us to this point of you filing the lawsuit?
Well, unfortunately, the state continued in its effort to try to find ways around what the voters put in place in 94 and reaffirmed in 96. And so they came up with what they call a cougar management plan, but their idea of management is this massive slaughter and not at all dictated by the behavior of any individual animals. Instead, they want to take out huge numbers of adult female cougars. They don't even know what the current population is. That 5,100 figure really is an estimate.
Mm.
So we just felt that that was outrageous, and we filed a lawsuit to make sure that any federal involvement would be done in a legal manner, and we are examining the state's actions right now. So we're going to be staying on them and really putting a lot of pressure on them on this, and we think everyone should contact the State Department and tell them to stop this plan. This is terrible.
Has the plan already been put into practice?
Well, it's been approved, and they're working on implementing it now. So I'm hoping so far no cougars have actually been killed under this plan, but that was part of why we filed the lawsuit, was to get their attention and let them know that we do not think this should go forward.
Uh-huh.
So we're staying vigilant right now.
Okay, and again, what can people do if they want to participate?
Well, it's really important that people let their state legislators know that this is an outrage, because the state legislature really should be protecting what the voters put in place. So I think that's the first phone call. And the next one should be, I think, to the governor's office, because the governor determines the activities of these agencies. They are beholden to follow what the governor wants. And it's very important that we let the governor know that we believe in a sane management plan of our cougars, and we don't want a wholesale slaughter.
Okay. And it's interesting, the press release then quotes the attorney for the plaintiffs saying, by any measure, killing 40% of the cougar population in Oregon. But those numbers sound like way more than 40%.
Well, it's tough to get the numbers down. Part of what happens is there really are just estimates, so
yes,
you're dealing with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have this five-year period,
oh,
and of course there is some recruitment each year to the population, meaning that they will have kits and, mm-hmm, and grow the population. Now, that's quite a moderate, it's very modest with an animal like a cougar. They're a top-of-the-line predator.
Mm-hmm.
They control their own numbers, and their numbers grow only as their prey is available.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not a fast-growing, they're a very slow-growing species, despite what you often hear in the press.
Mm-hmm.
So just getting the biology down is you know, difficult, and we're afraid maybe ODF&W doesn't understand the biology yet.
And so what is the timeline on this lawsuit? What should we expect to hear about next?
Well, I'm not sure what the next step will be. It's kind of now in the court's hands, and we'll see what happens next. As I said, you know, we're being vigilant on the federal and the state level. A lot of the time what happens is the state brings in they're called Wildlife Services, which I think is an ironic name for an agency that is literally, their job is to destroy wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
And so they will contract with them and have them come into the state. They're talking right now about doing that, but that hasn't, from what I understand, that hasn't actually taken place yet. So we're keeping an eye on that part of things, and we're also looking at the state right now to see if there are going to be separate actions that we need to take at the state level.
Uh-huh. So at this point, you're not asking, you are asking for an injunction to stop the implementation.
Absolutely.
And then
we've been we've been involved in the formation of the plan. We've flown in biologists from around the country that are absolutely the recognized experts on cougar biology to talk to them about all the flaws in this plan. Everyone we ran it by said this is an absolute outrage. I mean, this would put Oregon back 50 to 100 years to a time when we are just removing huge numbers of animals from the population.
So this passed because our Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission is made up of people who are mostly in favor of hunting, or why do you suppose it passed?
Well, interestingly, I think what happened is there's a lot of pressure on the commission, and I believe some members of the commission were not very sold on this plan. They saw some of the flaws, but there was a fair amount of peer pressure to do something, to claim that this was scientific in some manner. And I think they're just kind of riding on their reputation and trusting or hoping that people will assume that they really know what they're doing here. So I'm afraid that really they're operating in the dark and taking this kind of drastic and really reckless action is something that they haven't thought out carefully.
Right. Okay. Well, so again, you're asking people to call their state legislators and then call the governor's office.
Yeah, let's let everybody know that this is a bad plan. I know KBOO listeners, they take action, and I hate to say it, but I think that's what's going to stop this, is if you all out there will literally get going and pick up the phone and tell everyone you know that cares about cougars to do the same.
Okay, and I also want to ask you for an update on the horse and burro slaughter issue. Let's see, I have something here. Yeah. Whoops, that's Whaling. We're going to get to Whaling in a minute.
Good.
So what I have is a little confusing to me. I have an email that says, once again, your calls and emails have won the day. This was May 18th. And it says, earlier today, the U.S. House of Representatives unanimously approved an amendment to stop the commercial sale and slaughter of wild horses and burros. And then I have another one that says, call your senator about the next thing. And then suddenly it seems like we're back to square one in the House.
Well, we feel that way a lot here in Washington. Let me tell you, things don't always make a lot of sense. But let me see if I can make it, you know, something that makes sense to real people instead of inside the Beltway people.
Uh-huh.
What goes on here is you have to win it in so many stages. And with horses right now, just to give people a moment's background.
Yes.
It's an unbelievable situation that people really, I think most people are very unaware of. But in America, we actually do allow our horses to be auctioned off to what they call killer buyers and sent to one of three foreign-owned slaughter plants in the U.S. to be butchered and then to be sent overseas. Typically, the countries that where there's consumption of horse meat are Europe and Japan. And it's not something that, you know, Americans choose to eat. But it's not illegal for American horses to be used in this manner. And so what's happening is people that have horses that they, you know, maybe their child's outgrown them, or they're not able to still do pony rides anymore, or whatever their situation is. And this is, you know, former race horses. The Premarin industry overbreeds horses and keeps them pregnant in order to produce Premarin, which is a whole nother topic.
Yes. Uh-huh.
But they sell those foals every year to slaughter. So it's a terrible problem, and about 90,000 horses last year were trucked across the country and went through a terribly inhumane process of being slaughtered.
So now this is not just wild horses.
No, it is wild horses that are taken off the range and that are adopted out or sold to people and then go to slaughter, but it is bigger than that. It's domestic horses as well. A lot of the horses from, say, the Amish country in Pennsylvania, when they're no longer strong enough to pull the plow, are actually sent for this, or carriage horses. I mean, it's every type of horse that you can imagine, from a three-day-old foal to, you know, a 20-year-old pregnant mare. I mean, all of them can go to slaughter.
Uh-huh.
And do.
Uh-huh.
So this is something that we think there's no real purpose. We believe that people view horses in a way that that we think this is inconsistent with. We feel that there is a bond between them. They give us everything. They give us all of their working life. They give us loyalty. They're our heroes on the racetrack. They are our companions in, you know, show rings for small children. It's a whole world that doesn't involve treating them in this way. And they really are betrayed when this happens. They don't know what's happening. They are terrified. And because they are terrified, their slaughter is often incredibly inhumane because they'll flinch and not be properly stunned, as the law would provide for. So we see all kinds of problems with this. And we've been working now for many years to try to outlaw it. And there are bills that are sitting in Congress waiting for action. And as we all know, sometimes the chairs of the committees that the bills sit in just have a vested interest in not passing that legislation. And that's what's going on with the horse issue. So in order to get around that, we will try to find ways to bring the issue up right to the House floor instead of going through committee, because we know we have the votes. We have got, you know, almost 200 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives now on this legislation. So what you saw that was a victory email was applauding the House of Representatives for making a very positive vote, a unanimous vote, to protect wild horses from going to commercial sale and slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that would still have to go over to the Senate and get approval.
Mm-hmm. And it hasn't.
Well, it hasn't yet, and I don't believe it will, because Senator Conrad Burns, a Republican from Montana who is not friendly to any animal I'm aware of, and very unfriendly to many people, I might say, as well, he has declared that he will never let it through his committee, and he chairs this same committee over there. And so he's exerting a lot of influence on his buddies in the Senate and keeping it from being placed in that bill. So we are looking for other ways to keep pushing this forward, and that's why we had to call again for help, because we're now trying to get the bill itself, the regular piece of legislation, through committee, putting a lot of pressure on the committee chair, trying to get the leadership in the House to exert pressure on him.
So this is not an amendment. This would be its own bill.
You're right. That's okay. Exactly right. And it's exciting because this is the first time we feel we may have some movement. There may be some inching in the right direction, but it's all hard to tell. It's like trying to read smoke signals or some sort of very vague signals that come out of, you know, it's like a game of telephone. I hear from this staff member who's talked to that staff member who's talked to the member themselves, and it's all tough to tell.
It's a little embarrassing to admit it, but it sounds a little bit like Legally Blonde 2.
You know, that movie was not entirely fiction.
Yeah.
There are moments when I wish I could get, you know, just get a few moments with the chair and take him in for a facial or whatever would be required. I don't really care. But I just think, you know, this isn't obviously the way laws should be made. But the human reality is that people are vulnerable to these kinds of persuasions, and they're vulnerable to their ego has to be dealt with. And so we work every angle we can for animals here in Washington. And, you know, I think we're very persuasive, but that we'll see if we can get things through. This is an election year, so they're pretty distracted.
Uh-huh.
And we're trying to get floor time, which is hard to come by.
Uh-huh.
But I think if people will keep putting pressure on folks to do the right thing, for example, Darlene Hooley, who represents an area just outside of Portland, she voted well on this issue in the past when it's come to the floor, but she hasn't yet co-sponsored this bill.
Mm.
And it'd be nice for people who are in her district to let her know that they want her to do that.
And what bill is it?
It's H.R. 503.
Okay.
That's the title of it. It's the American Horse Slaughter Prevention Act.
And
you don't need to know
now,
that.
Now, what would happen then to the foals of the Premarin mares? What would happen to all these horses that are now going to slaughter? What's the idea?
Well, that's an important question. We fear that a lot of this creation of extra horses, this overbreeding or dumping of horses into the market, happens because there is a marginal profit. And if you do it with enough horses, you can make a fair amount of money. But it's pretty sad to think that that's what's driving it. But I think that is. So let's remove any possible profit motive, and that way these businesses might have to take responsibility for these animals. And frankly, even if they didn't want them and they wanted to euthanize them on the spot, I would prefer that those little foals go to sleep and never wake up, rather than being crowded into a truck with stallions and mares and other horses and trampled and then sent through a horrible process. Not that I'm suggesting that's the best thing. I believe that they would find homes. I mean, I think there are sanctuaries growing at a rapid rate for horses. There are other buyers at these same auctions, but the killer buyers will just often outbid them. So we're just trying to remove that profit motive.
Okay. So, and this would cover wild horses as well, and burros?
That's right. all the equines would be protected under this law. So it's H.R. 503, and people can contact Representative Hooley and ask her to please co-sponsor. Representatives Blumenauer and DeFazio and Wu have all co-sponsored so far, so we're very proud of them.
Good. That's good news. What about if you happen to know in Southwest Washington? We may have listeners there as well.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say that Mr. Walden is not a fan of protecting horses. He has not co-sponsored, and he voted no when the issue came to the floor. I'm trying to think of who else we have down south there that I need to tell you about. He's the main one.
Well, it's still worth phone calls to him.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I think letting him know that he's not in sync with his constituents is critical.
Yes, and
so
I would say that
in
Southwest Washington, that would be true. There's a lot of people there who would probably support this legislation.
Absolutely. We've seen polls over and over again across the country that show that, you know, upwards of 80 or 90% of Americans just do not want this happening.
Okay. Now, I'm going to change topics on you here again.
Sure.
And, I have to read a quote that I got in the email. It's just too good. From Carol J. Adams, and I can't say I know who she or he is.
But she's wonderful.
Is she? Well, you have to tell me who she is. But it says, even atheists believe they have a God-given right to do what they want with animals. And I just thought that was hilarious and wonderful.
How ironic
that
notion of God-given would even transfer to atheists. She's right, and she's an amazing author. She's written about the connection between animal abuse and women and feminism.
Mm.
She's very perceptive and has done some wonderful research on the topic.
So the political shift in the International Whaling Commission was on full display last week when they narrowly backed a non-binding resolution in favor of commercial whaling, which, of course, has alarmed environmentalists and senior officials in the United States, Australia, New Zealand, and Britain. And I noticed in researching this a little bit that pro-whaling countries have tried for several years to win a majority on the commission, both by persuading like-minded countries to join and by releasing scientific studies indicating that some whale populations are rebounding. Japan has recruited at least 19 countries, many from West Africa and the Caribbean, to join the commission and back expanded whaling. And I also heard rumors that they were recruiting these countries by giving them large amounts of financial aid.
Well, it is true. Japan's been extremely effective in their efforts to get the entire world to return to a scenario where we're slaughtering whales by the thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands, and they themselves are already doing that in violation of the IWC. They're doing it, calling it research, but the research whale flesh is actually sold on the market for a pretty penny. So it's quite a ruse, and they are very persuasive when they are able to offer countries tremendous financial aid. Togo joined the IWC and paid in cash, which was pretty telling to most of us.
Paid in cash? Do you have to pay to join?
You do. You have to pay to join. And it's obviously something that, you know, we're sensitive about because we don't want to use undue influence to try to control these countries. And it's a little sad to see Japan doing that. We know that the citizens of all those countries either have no interest in this or would not want their country advocating in this way. And yet, you know, it's being done all for money. It's sort of a new colonialism that's sort of taking hold on the whale issue. It's very, very unfortunate.
So we have just a couple minutes left. Can you tell us what is the immediate impact of this and what we should be watching for or doing?
Well, let me just say the good news is that there was a lot of concern that at this recent IWC meeting, we would see the reopening of commercial whaling, because they had gotten to the tipping point. So we were heartened that that did not happen. What passed was a non-binding resolution saying that commercial whaling bans aren't necessary and perpetuating the myth that whales eat too many fish. So, you know, what we're doing is we're trying to educate around the world and really encouraging the U.S. delegation to speak out against the idea that the whales are the ones eating too many fish, given all the studies that have come out on the human over-harvesting of the oceans and the serious impacts that's having on fish stocks now. So this is nonsense, and we're concerned because there's never a need for commercial whaling. Whales don't need to be controlled in that manner. If they're rebounding, they're barely rebounding. And why should we hit them with that and send them back into a situation where they're essentially going to be devastated again?
Mm-hmm.
And we're also concerned because there is no humane way to conduct this. And they use exploding harpoons, which is a lot like sending a bomb inside the body of a whale, and they can take hours to die from this method. So there's no humane way to do it. There's no compelling reason to do it. And it's being forwarded on this lie that whales shouldn't be eating the fish that they're eating. Talk about a God-given right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is what they're born to do. So
is there any way that people can support you in this work?
I think people should contact the White House directly, and I understand the cynicism that people might feel about that. But, you know, we've seen, even within this White House, we've seen a little bit of sensitivity on certain animal issues, and I think the whaling issue is one that resonates for a lot of people. So I think let's press them to realize that this is something people really care about, and let them know that this is not an acceptable thing, and the U.S. needs to be leading the way Australia is in preventing commercial whaling in the future.
Great. Well, thank you, Nancy. I'm so appreciative of your call, and if you just tuned in, we've been talking with Nancy Perry of the Humane Society of the United States in Washington, D.C. And thanks again for calling, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
It's such a pleasure to be here, and hey to everybody in Portland.
All right. Hey too, not hate. Yes.
That's right.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Lori. Bye.
All right. You've been listening to Speaking of Animals. I'm Lori Sonnenfeld. Thanks for listening today, and stay tuned for more great programming.
Lord, I hate to be choosing sides. Down to the wire, fight or flight. They try to tell me might is right, but there's no place left to run and hide, and I ain't going down without a fight. I am choosing sides. My side is the mountain side. My side is the rocks in the earth. My side is decay and rebirth. So much destruction our eyes can see. It's down to the split with humanity. We've been running out of time, and the chasm is growing deep and wide. Let's be choosing sides. Our side is the white side. Our side is the side of life. Our side is the wild side. I'll shout it from the mountain peaks. I'll scream it in the city streets. I'll blaze it in blood across my chest. I am human. I am human, yes.
And the time is 10 a.m. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Coming up next, People Rise Up features Sunset Commissions at 10:30, part one of an interview with journalist Amira Haas, and at 11, Democracy Now!